Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast who's bumped our heads on the console, and now I'm Bonnie Langford.
I'm Michael Jayston.
And I've noticed that all the Kershans are wearing Colin Baker's trousers.
We are back with Season 24, and it's time for Time and the Rani. Now, before we make a start, Richard, 2 weeks ago, when...
Is it that long, dude?
When we had our Colin Baker retrospective, Todd spent a few minutes just commenting on his general thoughts of the Sylvester McCoy era, because he's not joining us again until Survival. Do you have any comments, general comments on the Colin Baker era before we start Civil?
I did manage, thank you so much, Brendan, for lending me your intimate box set of Season 22. I did manage to get through almost half the entire thing. I don't really have anything constructive to say. I have noticed that Mr. Sayward has disappeared, and indeed it's only a mere echo for this story, and that a lot of our dear loved ones are about to depart, including Pip and Jane, and a lot of other people who we thought were going to depart are here, whether they like it or not. And actually, I think that some of them, some significant ones anyway, come to prove to us that there's a good reason they're there in the first place. This is my Indian summer. Mm. I'm very glad we're here.
Yeah, me too. I've said many times before that Time and the Rani was the first story I watched on broadcast as opposed to on VHS recording. And I vividly remember the day of episode one.
Being sick in his nappy. No, go on.
I was at school and none of my other friends were into Doctor Who at school. You know, it wasn't a thing.
It was a selective school.
Kids were into it. No, God, it wasn't. No, it wasn't selective. But I vividly remember the TV guide said it was a new season of Doctor Who. My parents had pointed it out to me. And my memory of that day was explaining to my friend Andrew Stevens why this was so exciting. And as I recall, he didn't get it, but he was quite excited for me, which was nice. Oh. And you remember the strangest things being a kid. I had these mittens. So they were fingerless gloves with a mitten top you could put over the top. And they looked like a brown cat, not unlike Sutek, in fact. We're recording at Richard's today.
I'm wondering where Sutek this is going to.
Mm. No, this is just the memory of my childhood and being so excited. That, you know, that feeling where you can't wait to get home. You're at school all day.
I know what happened. He was standing in the school loo, all those mirrors, and you rub them together, static electricity, and you were whirled off in a time storm
to this
very podcast.
Indeed. Well, I remember putting the videotape into the top-loading silver VCR and pushing down and pressing record and just sitting there transfixed. I adore this story.
I can see why this would appeal to a very young person.
That was actually how I felt about it, because remember, Richard, the previous season had gone out on a Saturday night, two episodes at a time, and we'd been used to Doctor Who being sort of stripped Monday to Thursday or Monday to Friday at sort of 6:30 p.m. before the ABC News. This time it was on in the middle of a sort of segment of the afternoon. I think it was 5:30 in the afternoon when children's programming normally happened.
It certainly was, and treated with much love as it hadn't been for a long time.
In fact, we'll get to it. They did show the entire season and then they showed Remembrance immediately afterwards.
So we all thought, oh, this is an oddly truncated season for those of us who couldn't or didn't watch Trial of a Time Lord.
Yeah.
I was at first year uni when Trial of a Time Lord played, so getting to see it. But I saw one or two episodes and then I think I died.
I actually remember ringing friend of the podcast Matthew Farrow immediately afterwards, and I may have told this story, and saying, yeah, you know, the new Doctor's good, but it's turned into a kids' program and I think I'm going to be watching it out of habit from now on. I think that was an incredibly, incredibly obtuse first impression of this story because, like you, Brendan, I really, really like this.
I love it too, and for wildly different reasons, which I guess we'll get to. This comes at you from an oblique angle, like much of this entire season. I think this is not only a rebirth for the series, and it's not just Cartmell we have to thank or Sylvester we have to thank. We actually have to thank JNT for this as well, interestingly. And I was very much involved in reading fandom, occasional jottings. But honestly, this time, this era, and we have Colin to thank as well, is the birth of all of the people that we look at now who are working on the show. Nathan himself, who was involved, becoming involved with fandom, I was certainly being interested in it. This is the time when it became incredibly interesting, and I'm going to come back to that thing. It's just like the 60s. Doctor Who is most interesting when it's talking about what's going on outside of itself and not referencing itself, and we get two whole stories this season which have not had anything to do with anything Doctor Who's done before. And they don't. And I'm not just talking narrative. This one itself, even though it's still about the past, is actually more about the whole thing of what's going on in the media, and in fact at universities, and how we're seeing the constructs around us. This is a really interesting program, and it looks good too.
Fantastic. I think there's a huge leap in the quality of the production, and Phil Sandifer, take a drink, dear listeners, has a video blog, which I mentioned during our live tweet a few weeks ago. And in the video blog, he compares the way that this is shot with, now I can't remember, it may be some scenes from Creature from the Pit, and just how much more innovative, how much more careful it is about creating a sense of space. And if you look at the location work, it is just a quarry. But
we've jumped
so much
a dimension. I know, we're actually in the IMC mining quarry in Slagchester again, aren't we?
We've
reached another dimension. We're post Kenny Everett video show. The titles themselves take us out of the second dimension and into the third, whatever we think of Oliver Elms. And I haven't even got to Kev McCulloch yet. But Mr. Elms and Mr. Gareth Edwards from Cal Video, who put this extraordinary thing together with state of the art, and it was extraordinary. And yes, it was like a video game, and that's also a very important thing. It felt like watching a comic in 3D.
Well, that opening shot of the TARDIS being strafed by those sort of lightning-coloured beams, I just thought, oh, my God, you know, this is a cartoon, this is terrible, but in retrospect, it's something that I really like, and it is something we haven't seen before.
Whereas I, at age 6, looked at that and thought, this is a cartoon, this is amazing.
Of course. And let's not forget what cartoons were back then. We had 2000 AD, we had Ian Moore, we had Neil Gaiman's Sandman coming out. Fandom was responding. The kids who were fans in the early 80s and late 70s were now starting to write and be involved themselves. The whole world will never be the same again. And this just happens to be right at the point of the zeitgeist when things are getting exciting and interesting.
It's funny that Pip and Jane Baker should be heralding us into that.
We should say goodbye to the past as well. They apparently wrote for Space 1979, Brendan. Have you seen their episodes?
Because
bugger me with an ethics catalogue if I can remember which ones they were.
Oh, I think they just wrote the one. Rod and I have recently finished watching Space 1999, and my God, it gets awful.
I'm betting it's a season 2 story.
Oh, it is. It is a season 2 story. Their Space 1999 story was A Matter of Balance.
Oh, my God, I remember that one.
Which concerns a man in his gold underwear luring a young Moonbase Alpha technician, i.e. so young she must have been bloody 13 when they got blasted out of orbit, in order to swap matter with her, because he's from an antimatter universe, he needs to trade places with someone from a matter universe, and they're going to do it to the whole of Alpha.
It's a bit Roman Polanski, isn't it, really? You can see why they were banned from writing ever again, except they weren't.
Can I just point out that the Pip and Jane Baker stories during the Colin Baker era were Brendan's favourites, and I can kind of see why, because they were a little oasis of normal, fun family tea time entertainment with very little cannibalism in them, you know.
A piquancy.
But they were straightforward and fun. Yeah. And, you know, they were pitched very young, but that's not an absolute crime when you're writing for Doctor Who. They were straightforward and simplistic, but they weren't horrible.
Do you think there was a great respect for young people in their writing? I'm thinking now of what they wanted to do with King Solomon and the baby in the opening credits of this story. You know what was going to happen?
They were going to cut Sarn in half?
It wasn't Einstein. That was Cartmell's idea. The Rani was going to appear just at the point of Solomon's dictum when the mothers were presenting the little child and saying, he's mine, no, he's mine. And Solomon, of course, declares, well, I'll cut him in half. And this big, swarthy, dark fella comes in, full of Eastern promise and mystery and smelling of musk. And he comes in with his massive scabbard and waves it about. So, I'll cut him in half then. And that's when the Rani was going to appear and she was going to kidnap him for his wisdom. Mm. And J&T said, well, no one's ever heard that story. Oh. No one even knows who that is.
Goodness.
And Cartmell said, thank buggery bollocks for that. Let's make it Einstein. Oh, and by the way, I've got a few other things I want to change as well.
Well, I think that by then they had pretty much taken over all of the script writing.
All of television in Europe. Everywhere,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. The episodes of Tenko are second to none.
Have you seen pictures of... They did not write. Have you seen pictures of Beth McCulloch?
Doctor Who facts.
He gets to appear in Delta and the Bannerman spoilers, so you get to see him with his ludicrous ponytail. Anachronistic ponytail. He looks exactly like Pick Baker. I think it's one and the same person.
He's still with us and still working in
Which
Sydney.
Which one?
Kev.
Oh, yeah. Hello.
I don't think he's listening.
Deaf, as he was many years ago.
During
the writing of the score for these stories. Go on.
Something you alluded to, Richard.
Yes.
Pip and Jane Baker, they appear on the DVDs for all three of their stories. They appear on the commentary for this. And
sludging through forests, turning people into trees.
Yes, that's right.
Where was the Witchfinder General when you needed them?
But they talk about how they found it... they enjoyed working with Andrew Cartmell less than they enjoyed working with Eric Sandler. And they don't... I mean, it being Pip and Jane, they're not saying that from a personal standpoint. They're saying it from a professional standpoint. I think maybe it was because Eric let a few more of their things slide, whereas Andrew Cartmell was like, no, we need to have Einstein because this is a story about science, ostensibly, not King Solomon. We need to have Hypatia. We need to have Louis Pasteur.
Oh, she said.
Yeah. And, you know, they're
cutting up babies is what we do. I mean, Saywood said, you know, he promised us that we'd be able to eat a child this season.
But, you know, one thing they wanted, which was undermined, and I think it's a mistake, is they planned for Lacertia to be a forest planet.
Yeah, and isn't this telling? Yeah. What do you all think about this?
Because they didn't want a quarry. They're like, Doctor Who's
not another freaking IMC quarry. And Andrew Morgan was the one who pushed it. Andrew Morgan directed this one and I think did a fine job, actually.
Yeah, I do too. I think it looks really good.
Did you know Bonnie was written as being scintillating in this one?
Well, she
J&T's direction was she shall be scintillating. This is reflected in the audience appreciation index of 41. Which is 6 points lower than the previous season, which only Todd watched.
It's about 10 points lower than Salmonella poison.
There are some lovely directions in the scripts, though, and I have to thank. Did you see some of the notes? Pip and Jane are fabulous for their notes. Icona is humping Mel. He's actually one of the
yes,
one of the little points that I think we have many things to treasure. See, I love the sewers. I do. Yeah, there's a title for the episode. Don't you notice they didn't have any concrete pipes in that quarry? This could be so the BBC brought one in, and just to make it look a bit more alien, they stuck some blue Christmas tinsel in it. It's a freaking pipe! Up his freaking pipe! Blue tinsel! And there's this, I know, cut, but there's this blue tinsely rocks. And have you noticed why? There is actually germane plot-driven reasons for this. Tetraps are terrified of tinsel. The spray guns, tinsel, tinsel, tinsel. Well, this is the gayest thing ever, and we'll get more to this later. This is the gayest episode of Doctor Who so far.
The Tetraps were, in fact, conquered by the people of Carfel, famous for their tinsel-based technology.
Mm. Oh, they were too.
They were.
I think it is a mistake not having it in the forest, because Pip and Jane's whole rationale with having it in the forest is that the Lacertians are indolent because they don't want for anything. Nature provides everything for them. There's no need to strive.
They were a Gauguin-esque landscape of South Pacific maidens and young gentlemen with scaly orify.
But if you're in a quarry, you definitely want to improve your lot.
Well, they eat rocks. Very easily solved.
They're Gorons from The Legend of Zelda, video game stuff for you kids out there.
It means nothing to me.
You'd like Gorons. I'll show you a picture later.
Webs. But really, does it work? We do have Mother Cumberbatch. And we do have Donald Pickering.
Well, I know Reunited, it's a Faceless Ones reunion, of course.
It really is.
Yeah, they were going to get Colin Gordon as Icona, but yeah, just no. I have to say, Mark Greenstreet, I think...
He is quite.
And he's a good actor as well.
Yeah, he actually is, because he hasn't got a lot to work with. Yeah. He pouts at Mel very nicely. Mm. I'm going to say Bonnie pouts back very nicely too.
In that outfit. Which I have worn.
Did you keep your bum nice as well? How does she manage to keep a white arse the entire way through?
Well, yeah, I think the pants are made of unstable molecules, like the X-Men and Fantastic Four uniforms.
I just don't think the mud would dare see Bonnie Langford's clothing.
Well, the mud, you see, doesn't know if it's Bonnie Langford or Kate O'Mara. Bonnie Langford, it might get away with. Kate O'Mara would not stand for that.
Can we touch upon our Kate?
Well, Todd doesn't like this version of the Rani because I think he thinks that she's a little bit over the top. But I think just slightly... But I do think if you're going to cast Kate O'Mara as a villain, like, get her to chew the scenery. It's a waste of time for her to...
What is she going to do? You know, she wrote that letter to JNT's, rescue me from this Hollywood miasma of palm trees and swimming pools and get me back into some mud.
Yes, indeed.
And that's exactly what she said. She did say she didn't enjoy this one as much, but... Yeah.
I think part of that was, of course, she had a pre-existing relationship with Colin. They've worked together before. Yeah. She, you know, had worked with Sylve and Bonnie before as well. She was also very self-conscious about having to impersonate Bonnie Langford while Bonnie was on the set, because she kind of went, I need to impersonate her without totally taking the mic.
And she achieves that dismally, yes. It is a complete micturation of a performance from one point to another, and you know, I kind of like it for that.
It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
She's silencing the critics. This is what I think about the whole meta thing of this. This is actually making the mockeries of the fans that are bitching about the last season
in a
really clever way.
You know, a few months before this, it hadn't been seen on the UK, but a few months before this, Star Trek The Next Generation premiered
in
the US. And the
and Blackadder.
Yeah, Blackadder 2. Yeah. The mid-premiere cliffhanger for when Encounter at Farpoint was divided up into two episodes was Patrick Stewart turning to the view screen and saying, if we're going to be damned, let's be damned for what we really are. And I think that's what Doctor Who is doing here.
Yes,
I think the last 2 years, Doctor Who has been slightly ashamed to be a rather silly, rather cheap sci-fi series, whereas Time and the Rani says, we're going to put Kate O'Mara in a red wig and dress her up as Bonnie Langford in a set surrounded by tinsel, and you're going to damn enjoy yourself.
Let us look at, for the first time in a long time, in fact, ever, Jonathan Powell and, you know, the gods that be said to JNT, we actually need to see an audition tape of whoever you want to cast. And weren't they interesting? And doesn't Sylve shine? And look who he was put against.
Dermot Crowley.
And Janet Fielding.
He's put against Janet Fielding. I beg your pardon.
And look who she plays. Iron Lady.
Yeah, she plays Thatcher. It's Thatcher in that scene.
This is who the Rani is in this.
Yeah.
My take on this, can I tell you why I think this show is interesting? Are we up to this
point?
If you were at university in the 80s or early 90s, the word semiotics was something you was said as about as often as I'll have a half a pint, thanks, only make it a triple. It was, can I nick a fag? Everything was postmodern. Now, postmodernism, as we've touched on before, we're actually going back to, remember when we were talking about this sort of stuff in the early 70s before we lost a great many listeners and you had to bring Ton in? Yeah, that time. But why I think this era of Doctor Who is interesting and why I think we're actually at a turning point and why it probably couldn't live very much longer because it's so much of the now and it's jumped the shark. It's actually jumped the entire whale pod. We're now talking about critical theory at a university level. It's actually lampooning not just itself, but the whole of media and TV and actually politics, because that's what postmodernism does. Mm. All right, bear with me. Postmodernism, you see, as it works, with its resignation to bottomless fragmentation and ephemerality, it generally refuses to contemplate the question of how we can build or represent or attend to the surfaces of modern life with the requisite sympathy and seriousness that you need in order to get behind it and identify central meanings in everything that's going on and how you fit into the world. And this post-Murdoch thing and this post-Murdoch consumer TV thing of you just eat it and be happy. And this was all being questioned at this time. And we were even getting this sort of thing in the critical theory when you had academics actually starting to write about Doctor Who itself. And you had kids at university who were reading this stuff and thinking, I think I'd like to get into TV one day. Most of those kids are now working on a show called Doctor Who. Mm. But I would also say what this is and what postmodernism is at the point in the mid-80s to late-80s is actually the study of the collapse of time horizons. Yeah, really. And these were terms we used. And the preoccupation with instantaneity, with the moment. If you don't think postmodernism is relevant past the 80s either, look at how we live with our iPhones. This is who we are. But let me just say, what this means for Doctor Who now in 1987 is that, as McHale, the theoretician, put it, it's a shift from the epistemological to the ontological dominant aesthetic, which sounds like something you'd hear in Dragonfire. And it will. But what this means is there's a shift from the kind of perspective that allows the viewer to see Colin Baker's Doctor having a bearing on the meaning of a complex but nevertheless singular form of reality, a singular view of the world, a modernist view of the world, to now the viewing of McCoy's Doctor as a foregrounding of questions, if you like, as to how to radically oppose these different realities and how they can collide and coexist and how we live in them and how we interpret this miasma, this confusion. But the boundary, if you like, between fiction and science fiction has as a consequence dissolved. And Doctor Who is right on the point of that. That is the very definition of postmodernism. And studying architecture, as I was doing in this year, we were also reading the linguistic theoretics of postmodernism. These are terms they actually used. I'm quoting straight from my old textbooks. Watching Doctor Who at this point, I guess I would say postmodernist characters often seem confused as to what and which will be around them and how they should act with respect to it. So what's going on in the world? There's a line from Jorge Luis Borges' Labyrinths that we've talked about before from the 60s Doctor Who. It's really tenable now. It goes, who was I? Today self-bewildered, yesterday's forgotten and tomorrow's unpredictable. That's Sylvester McCoy in Doctor Who. The question mark tells it all. And that was a symbol in itself of postmodernism, the question mark.
Yeah, well, something we discussed during the Colin era was how much it relies on the past without really doing anything new. And Nathan, you used the word predictable.
I thought you were going to say cannibalism.
cannibalism as well.
I mean, it kind of is cannibalism. It is remaking Doctor Who out of habit and doing the beats that we're just used to.
Whereas this story, as Richard, you were saying, is on the cusp. We do have something old in the form of the Rani, but so much of this story feels so new, even though it's doing things that other texts have done. It's kind of doing things that Doctor Who hasn't really done before. The closest we've got to the Rani impersonating Mel is, you know, a couple of robot Doctor Who's in the past. But to me as a kid, that's like, oh my God, that's so exciting. But yeah, I think because this takes earlier ideas and reinvents them in that postmodern way, not just regurgitating what there's been before, but taking the pieces and going, hey, here's something new. That makes it exciting.
Do you know what this show felt like in 1987, watching this as a student and starting to just to go to bars and having friends who, both at university and outside of that, who actually weren't here 2 years from now? I had lost quite a few friends by 1989-90, and it's just pause to reflect. But this show feels, at this point, we're starting to look at turning the women, the gays, the blacks, the colonized peoples and their repatriations of their own histories and turning it around and celebrating the nonsense of it all and the shortness of it all. Here we've got disparate tribes of post-HIV queer Britain, colourful outcasts, if you like, and scaly in their self-disregarding infirmity, lolling about but kind of not willing to change, proud of who they are, if you like. Ruled by an ironic lady or an iron lady, you know, who is a vulgar idea of what ruling class is, you know, or a camp dominatrix, or, you know, a Thatcherist trope. Mm. And at the end, right at the end of this story, they pour away the cure that could have completely changed them into, you know, I guess what everybody else thinks they should be, because their dissonance is now their strength. That's why I love this story. This to me is actually about queer England dealing with HIV and AIDS.
You know, I'd never thought of it like that. But
and I wonder if Pip really and Jay knew it.
It wouldn't surprise me if that was part of Cartmell's influence, because he was incredibly politically aware. Yeah. He famously said during the job interview, "What do you want to achieve as the script editor of Doctor Who?" He says, "I want to bring down the government."
That's right, he did too. And Alan Moore, who did Watchmen and all those other terrific things, and is as mad as a Cat Weasel fan can be, looks exactly the same. Vale, Jeffrey Bell. All of those things have come together. Thank you for indulging me on that spiel. But, I felt that strongly about this show, and I actually still feel it now.
And you know what? Queerness and queer ideas are something which is going to come to the fore in this era.
Very much so.
Even the last season, which has several instances of exploring Ace's sexuality, has instances of queerness.
Well, none of us
queerness.
Are little girls anymore, aren't we?
That's right. But, I mean, the one that we'll really come to in a couple of months is, of course, the Happiness Patrol. But I'm going to keep my powder dry on that one.
Phrasing. But yeah, that's my point. That was not the big first queer story in New Doctor Who. I think this one is. Mm-hmm. And it's not just that we've got a change of Doctor, who's now silly and lyrical and not informed. The Sixth Doctor was all modernism and knowledge.
I know everything, yeah.
Oh, brash modernity, if you like. But the Seventh is actually Roland Barthian. Can we say those things? It's post-rational playfulness. That's what that guy was writing about.
Did you know recently in Doctor Who magazine, Johnny Morris?
Oh, I love him.
Yeah, he wrote a queer reading of the Macra Terror. And how Ben's...
It's actually, they're all in little shorts, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. They're all in little shorts. Little white women boots. Keep throwing themselves at Jamie, and he's just like, get away from me.
So to speak.
And Ben, of course, has a huge struggle with his identity in the story.
But then he goes topless, doesn't he?
he goes
as
topless.
You do.
He has a huge struggle with his identity in the story. Yes. Does he conform and betray his friends, or does he stick by his friends?
Yes.
And as Johnny Morris puts it, and, of course, Ben saves the day by virtue of being the only one not locked in the closet at the end.
Oh, my goodness, it's so true.
It's fantastic.
It's so right that the Macra were the first to be brought back from, am I correct, in the new series in Gridlock? They were the first dog monster, other than Khaled mutant things.
No, they were absolutely the first, and we'll put that up on FTE.
That's right.
The only monster from the old series ever to come back in the new series, in fact.
So how do you feel about all of that?
Well, I think that there's something really very much to be said for that. But on a much simpler level, too, I think the show is rediscovering being fun and doing things that science fiction fans are appalled by. I think the dress-up thing is something that serious science fiction fans think is ridiculous.
Appalling. I should say
has no place in the program.
Absolutely. And should never have been. I should say at this point, 1987, dear listener, this was the flowering of young Nathan as in fandom, the blossoming, if you like. And now that we're touching on dress-ups.
I have already confessed to dressing up as Jacqueline Pierce.
That's the first time I saw young Nathan. You can imagine a crisis of semiotic.
I think it was a little bit later than that, dear listener.
I had a chronic hysteresis.
Crisis on infinite server lands.
But I think, generally speaking, you've gone from Doctor Who being a slog, this duty that we have to a program with a 20-year history.
Yes!
To kind of throwing all that away. And the Rani is back, but she's only been in it once before and she's not really very much like she was, and we only have to reach back in our memories 2 years to know who she is. But it doesn't really matter. Like, she's someone with huge hair and, fabulous
point?
Arm gestures and things.
She still wields out death from the death-wielding mirrored ball in the disco, another HIV reference.
Yeah.
That, the mirror ball now causes death.
Yeah.
But the point is that she is to be made fun of and she is to be mocked, like all figures in authority who actually can wield out death by set clause 28 or section 28, by withholding money for research into drugs that could actually save people's lives. And finally they did in 96. Mm. But we still had to wait those 10 years for me. And for everyone else around us, of course, who was watching our community be more than decimated. Yeah, she is Thatcher. She is the powers that be. But the point is, we're not to be threatened by them. We are supposed to find them funny. We're supposed to lampoon and mock and not take on their idea of how we should be. Even when they give us the cure, throw it back in their faces. We don't need them.
Well, she gets very much a cartoon ending, doesn't she, where she's sort of tied up by her
retainer. Her hirsute servants.
Berlin Club. A double XL. Actually, no, it's just Vauxhall Tavern, isn't it? Or indeed Fitzroy Tavern, if you're kind of around in the London in the 80s. Yes.
Oh, dear.
They're all fanboys. Tetrips are fanboys, saying that the Tetrips are actually Gary Lee and everyone else on Doctor Who Bulletin. Oh, it's all dreadful and all it's hateful. And none of you are as good as you should be.
Yeah. I think the
your race is so inferior to ours. That's that wonderful line when Tubby Tetrup says that to lithe and lovely Mark Greenslip or whatever his name is.
I can't remember who it was, but many years ago when Richard and I used to frequent Gallifrey Base, then Outpost Gallifrey.
Oh, we had a time, dear listener.
Yeah. You had four, I believe. But there was a young man in America with whom I was rather enamored. I can't remember who it
was. Andrew Dundas?
No. But I remember Richard says, oh, no, you don't want to go with him. He's got a belly not unlike Urek the Tetra.
I'm so sorry for memory of that. I was Mary Whitehouse on that site.
You were also the Trousers of Doom?
I was.
And cellulose wallpaper paste?
That's right. I was.
And Richard Stone.
The folly of youth. Go on.
I think that's actually how we met.
Now, haven't we? Yeah.
We met on the forum before we met in real life.
Yeah, no, we did.
And when we met, I said, oh, you must be Richard Stone on the thing. He said, yes, amongst others. I'm like, what do you mean? And Mrs. Mary White. I said, you're Mrs. Mary White. You didn't think it was the real one, did you?
This is the point. All of that came about because of McCoy's era. Oh, no, that's not fair. Colin polarized us in ways, but I don't necessarily think in ways that were for the positive, in that they coalesced rather than bringing together. Whereas McCoy's era, thanks to Cartmell and McCoy and J&T, gets that things can be disparate, unalloyed, and possibly unremarkable, and yet be celebrated and wonderful when you mix them all up together. We can actually be all of many colours and still get along and actually have some fun doing it.
Yeah.
This feels fun.
Exactly. One of the sometimes criticisms, sometimes just comments laid at this season is that every story feels so different from each other, so there's a completely disparate tone. I actually think that's one of its strengths, and well, I think one of the reasons it's so pronounced, though, is there's only four stories.
I think it's what Doctor Who is for as well. I mean, I thought season 22 was a whole lot of space corridors and cannibalism. And I'm not going to let that go.
Okay, if we're going to go on about the queer theory thing, I'm sorry. If you asked me earlier why I wasn't a fan of Colin's era, and just to put a shadow moment on this, I can't get past, and neither can my women friends or my queer women friends who are in theory and politics now, the act of the Doctor strangling the girl who is his, if you like, the adumbrate of his granddaughter, but the person in his charge and physically attacking her. And it simply is not something this show should have ever done, and I've never been able to get past it.
And they don't walk back from it either, because that happens to her the entire time she's on the show.
That's actually the reason I can't watch Colin's era.
I think that you should see what
it's like. I like his audios.
I think you should see what it's like when Mel takes over, because that departs with Perry.
Yeah.
And so here...
because they show they can kill her! Or Mario de Brian Blessed, which is worse. Yeah. I don't know which could say.
And so Mel is really perky and really likable. She has no kind of discernible character. She's Bonnie.
Have you noticed how good she gets when they actually just start writing for her as generic Doctor Girl?
Yeah, but later on this season.
And look at how good she is. I've been blitzing for the last 3 weeks every Bonnie Langford, Sylvester McCoy and Colin Baker audio I could get my hands on. And thanks to James Selwood, friend of the podcast, who's always here in spirit. I've listened to almost all of them now, and she's fantastic.
Oh, she is so,
and
so
dry
good.
And smart and sensitive and a little bit pantsy.
Yeah, yeah. What I love about her in this story is that for the first three quarters of it, Mel is basically the Doctor. It's yes. Mel. It's Mel who makes contact, starts stirring up the resistance, finds out what's going on in the culture of this planet, while the Doctor is unknowingly a collaborator with the villain.
Very much so.
And
also completely emasculated.
Yes, absolutely, because he is totally under the thrall of the Rani, and any time he asks a question, she just kind of throws her head from side to side and says, oh, no, Doctor, it's fine, cretin.
But, and she beats him up quite a bit.
Could you have seen, if they said this was written for Colin, I can't see how that could have ever worked.
I don't think it would have been better with Colin. And I think part of the problem with that is that Colin's Doctor was already kind of the universe's whipping boy. In a way that Peter was as well. You know, his Doctor gets mistreated and locked in cells and blah, 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 blah. And the way Colin plays it, I could never really accept him being duped in that way. Whereas I can I can accept it from Sylvester because A, he's just regenerated. And B, he has this unpredictable quality that Colin doesn't have.
And the malapropisms. It's a perfect thing. He even cites malaprop. He even in the way that Colin was always so effusive and articulate and always with the perfect phrase, the bon mot. Whereas I really wish Sylvester had kept going with this as much as I wish he'd kept going with the spoons of all the malaprops and mixing things up. I love it. It's gorgeous.
Mean, Colin can be silly and Colin can be wrong and all of those sorts of things. And I think
yeah, he proves it on the audio and vulnerable.
Yeah, I like that. But here, I think they deal with the sort of regeneration thing. I mean, the post-regeneration trauma thing is just a terrible idea.
Is it though?
Yes, yeah.
Why?
Well, because you want to see what the new Doctor's like and you don't get to. You get to see sort
don't
of bumbling
like
things.
It out? Well, I think it's as close as he ever gets to foreplay.
Well, but the Christmas invasion gets it right. It gives us a taste.
Puts him in
of
his jammies, his saucy mix.
you get a bit of an idea of what he's going to be like when he confronts the Santas with the sonic screwdriver. But we basically have to wait an hour, and then he has his hero moment, and he sort
it
of
does
rocks
work
in and
wood.
Saves the day.
What's it's that tree made of?
Yes.
But here, they really throw away the regeneration thing. Sylvester's working at pretty, well, you know, as close to full capacity as he ever gets. And the only thing is that he's confused about who the Rani is.
Do you think he's messy in this? How do you feel about that?
I think Sylvester is really, really fun to watch. I don't know. I think he does sort of resignation and sadness very well.
This is the thing. He really does, and you don't expect it. But again, if you go back to my spiel earlier, it's all about putting things together that are disparate and dissonant and actually making them work. So he does this, I feel, better than probably seen since Troughton
I think Troughton sort of outclasses him as an actor, but Troughton does that to just about everyone else who's ever played a Doctor.
I will take that, but that's not to in any way denigrate Sylv.
No, I think he's really a compelling performer. He's physically really interesting. He's sort of sweet and funny, and he does vulnerable very well. And just comparing his relationship with Mel in this story to Colin's relationship with Perry in his first story, it's almost an apology. And remember the final line of the Twin Dilemma is, you know, I'm the Doctor whether you like it or not. And here Sylvester goes, I'll grow on you, Mel, I'll grow on you. And he's terribly sweet about it.
Yes.
And so it is them doing this right and trying, I think, in some way to heal the horrific wound inflicted on the program in the Twin Dilemma.
What I find interesting about that comparison to the Twin Dilemma is, like in the Twin Dilemma, you get a fight scene in this story between the Doctor and the Companion. But the difference is, this is a comic wrestling match that Bonnie and Sylv get into. And Bonnie
and
makes
wins.
The first...
Yeah,
she wins. Like, she throws him over her shoulder. And it's Bonnie doing that.
Yeah.
I mean, they're the same height, so it's pretty easy.
Brendan does it too.
Yeah.
He's doing it now.
But
we'll post pictures, do listen.
What I absolutely adore about that
scene... Oh, we have. Yes.
What I absolutely adore about that scene is when they realize who each other are, because she doesn't know it's the Doctor and he doesn't think it's Mel. And when they realize there's a genuine warmth between them, and it sells the fact that he is the same character.
Yeah.
But the reason I think it wouldn't have worked with Colin is, of course, when the script was written for Colin, he took the part of Baius in the final scene and gets blown up. And that was going to be the end of the Sixth Doctor. He was going to get blown up saving the Lycurgians instead of Baius. And I think the reason this scene works better is because it's the first meeting between the Doctor and his companion rather than this bittersweet, we've remembered each other just before you die.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the first place we see that melancholy from Sylvester. He cites his influences as Patrick Troughton, because that was the last time he really watched Doctor Who, because he became an actor after that and wasn't in on Saturdays. Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, which is all where the physical stuff
but
comes from.
But J&T wanted that as well. Yeah, that was part of the instruction.
But his other influence is one of his grandmothers. And he says she lived to 100 or close to it. And all of her friends had died. And she just, as Sylv says, she just had this wonderful sadness of having had a great life, but no one she shared it with was there anymore. Mm. And he's like, when I was told the Doctor is 900 years old, I thought, how many times has that happened to him?
Mm.
And when he goes, sort of, it doesn't bode well for my seventh persona, you feel that weight of, oh no, I'm getting it wrong again. And how many times has he gotten stuff like this wrong?
And we will touch on that even in this very brief Indian Summer of Sylvester McCoy's career. There's a lot of other stuff, though, isn't there? There's a lot of books. There's a lot of audios. There's a lot to be discovered and continue with.
Well, I've recently started reading every single Doctor Who fiction book. I started
I remember when you were you.
Do you remember when you were young, Nathan? Things like this?
No.
Because I did too. I didn't get very far.
Because, you see, I drew up a spreadsheet with with the page counts of pretty much
for every kind of fan, isn't
pretty
there?
Much every Doctor Who fiction novel, and figured out reading 40 pages a day, it's going to take me about 9.5 years. So I'm up to Timeworm Apocalypse, which is the third new adventure. And the difference, when Terence Dix and Nigel Robinson write for Sylv and when John Peel writes for Sylv, it makes him really grumpy and angry.
Oh, God.
It just jars. But Terence Dix, who never writes for Sylv on television, never writes any of his novelizations, gets the character.
I loved Exodus. Did I give you a whole pile of those?
You sold me some of your NAs, yeah.
That's right. No, that's right. I didn't give. I sold for a reason. And let me tell you that the shelf has been amply filled by things I'd rather read. But I'm glad you're enjoying them. I remember Exodus as being very good as well and very much continuing on the time of the Rani feel of that first season.
But I think the reason that Terence is able to get Sylv so right is that Sylv kind of instinctively gets the core of the Doctor right, whereas I think Colin at the beginning didn't have a chance to because he's being told, be nasty, be nasty, be nasty. I think he gets it towards the end of Trial. And I said this a couple of weeks ago that, you know, he's just hitting his stride and then they fire him. Whereas Sylvester, because he has so little knowledge of the show and because his memory of the show is the 60s when the character was very bare bones, and that was his perception. He's like, I don't want the Doctor to be constantly going on about being the president of Gallifrey. I don't want him
which
to be
which is in the constellation of Casterbarus, binary location, blah, blah.
So, yeah, his whole thing is trim it back to basics. He's funny, he's silly, but deep down he's really sad. And we get all of that in this first
story.
So
would you be with two wives to support?
Sylvester, not Patrick.
There's a lovely interview. Actually, it might go over a couple of issues of Doctor Who magazine. Do you remember this one a couple of years ago? I've got it in there. I'll pull it out. Just talking about his early childhood and really how difficult it was. And I think he brings that pathos and bathos, not necessarily a lesser thing, into his performance. I can't say how much I love this Doctor, but I think I've probably given it a fair whack.
I like him a great deal as well. I think he's really, really great. And it is... It's nice to have someone who will kind of lurk on the periphery of scenes. It's not all about him.
Not in the way that Pertwee did.
I'm just imagining Pertwee like Betty Davis in Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte saying, oh, Joan, you don't need all these lines, do you? And that's
we don't
why...
need to cast that Welsh washerwoman. I'm very versatile.
And that's why we got Olivia de Havilland instead. no Olivia de Havilland in this, of course. But I think also the reason we have such a strong cast is possibly because Andrew Morgan Andrew Cartmell and JNT kind of went, yeah, this isn't a bad script, but it's perhaps not the strongest script, so we're going to get an incredibly strong cast. So you've got Kate, you've got Wanda, you've got Donald, you've got Mark Greenstreet.
They put the effort and the money into this
one. Yeah, yeah. And what seems strange to me is this year, the design and the direction just seems so much better, but I can't imagine they have any more money than last year.
Yeah, I agree. There is something more inventive about it.
It's only budgeted for three stories this season.
Of course, and the two three-parters are always made in the same production block, which is how the new series saves money as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll be touching on that later in the season. I think it looks extraordinary. They're the best model effects, thank you, Mike Tucker, I've ever seen in Doctor Who.
Mm.
And I'm a bit of a fan of the shiny things. Yeah, and yeah it is. It's right up there, isn't it? Well, it's Terrahawks was only a couple of years before, and we're owing a lot to that. Sue Moore did the Tetraps, who also designed Zelda. And this is state-of-the-art TV in 1997 in England.
I have tried to find it, but I'm afraid I can't. So I do apologise if this is you. But a friend of the podcast, when I was live tweeting, said that they didn't really like the Rani's lab set. And I really can't understand that because there's depth of field, there's things in the foreground, there's things in the midground, there's things in the background.
They've never been to a basement disco?
There's a roof! It has a roof! You know,
that is actually a very special thing for this show. Yes.
Yeah. Remember back in Marco Polo where Barry Newbury couldn't have a roof because the sound guy kept saying, oh, can't get me mic in there, mate.
Mm. I do think it is a little bit of a light entertainment set, and particularly when she starts the machine.
It does look like Sail of the Century.
Yeah, 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 yeah. But, you know, it's Doctor Who. It's got lots of lovely triangles in it.
Thank you. Another gay motif. The sky is pink.
Yes.
Everyone's wearing rainbow colours. The triangles are everywhere. Yeah. The pyramid motif, of course, all of that. I think it's deliberate that it looks like a Bruce Forsyth or our own Nicholas Parsons. We own him.
Yes.
Because he's been Doctor Who very soon. It looks like a game show because that's, again, part of this terrifically clever meta. I want to believe this was done deliberately to completely take the mic duration out of the entirety of British TV this year.
Well, think about when John Nathan Turner first comes along and we get after season 17, which did look cheap and drab and had lots of brown cardboard corridors in it, and then we get The Leisure Hive, which is just a studio-bound production like season 17, but done with a bit of flair and inventiveness.
So powerful that there are Golems still in this episode.
That's
there's no Golem at the end.
But here I think it's the same thing, and I don't think it's like super successful because it is a bit shiny and game showy. And if we were going for realism, which, let's face it, the moment you put Kate O'Mara in a Bonnie Langford wig, you're not.
That's not what this is meant to be achieving, no.
See, I think the reason they don't go for realism is because they don't have the money. So they go for the comic book aesthetic. They go for the bright colours and the solid shapes. As a kid, the pyramid and triangular motif, you know, like most kids, I was intrigued by the pyramids and the legends of Egypt. So immediately there's something recognizable for kids there. I wanted keypads that were triangular with little circular buttons on them. I remember watching the story over and over again, trying to figure out the interface. Like, okay, he's pressing in 953. What signifies 9? What signifies 5? What signifies 3? It fires the imagination on that level. And then the people who are older looking at it are able to appreciate the critical theory behind it and the postmodernism behind it. It's Doctor Who working on multiple age levels again.
It is.
Just, you know, and really, I don't think we've had that since early Pete.
I don't think we've had it in such purity since the 60s. It takes the everyday and subverts it and turns it on its head and makes of it something much bigger and it's been very different. Yeah. Doctor Who has always been about this period in the late 80s, early 90s. It actually has always been about this time. It's just reached its apotheosis. Have a drink, do listen.
And, you know, I wonder why this is so successful because, of course, you know, we're on the planet Zog with the people of the Zogs being threatened by an alien overlord.
It's the Dominators again. I mean,
it really is.
Why is it so good in comparison? It's not just the design work and it's not just Kate O'Mara.
No, we're having fun. I mean, the story is simplistic because it is Pip and Jane, and it is something that we've seen a lot of times before where you've got, you know, a rebel who wants to goad a population into overthrowing the oppressors, and then you've got Baius who's saying, no, no, take it easy, we're not going to do that. I was actually thinking of Death to the Daleks and Galloway, remember, who who looks like he's collaborating the entire time and then is brave enough to overthrow the Daleks, just like Baius does here. And so even though Baius is politically wrong, I think, in his approach, and that's how we're supposed to see it, he's not a bad guy. He's still brave and he still cares about his people. And I think, you know, that is a story that's been told over and over again in Doctor Who.
Yes.
So it's a simple kind of template that we've seen before, but it's kind of a bit of a relief to get that. And even during the Colin Baker era, I think, Brendan, you found that that sort of straightforwardness and just the sort of fun in the Pip and Jane stories, neither of which I think were particularly good, but, you know, that there was something really enjoyable there. And I think I grudgingly gave Terror of the Vervoids the bronze medal in the Colin Baker era, not because it's a great story, but because it's just terrifically fun. And I think the same is true here. I don't think Time and the Rani is a great script, but gosh, it's enjoyable to watch.
It is.
I think another reason it succeeds so well is what you said, Richard. There is actually a lot of theory and a lot of thought behind it, which even if you don't get it, you can sense that there's something deeper going on. You know, and I've said this many times before about Doctor Who stories that we've discussed on the podcast, things like Frontier in Space, which, you know, as a kid, I would never have realized the political dimension of it as related to the real world. But as an adult, it makes me appreciate it all the more. Whereas something like Time Lash, which I did say during the Colin era, I enjoy Time Lash because it's a straightforward story, there's not really a lot behind it.
No.
It's just a narrative, and that's fine. Whereas this has that extra queer dimension and the rebel dimension and fighting against corrupt authority. Can I talk a bit about the science?
Hey, dark matter.
Okay, so we have an asteroid composed of strange matter in this story. Now,
In fact, that was so important that that was what Pip and Jane wanted to call the
call
story.
The story.
Yeah. It was going to be called Strange Matter, and I do think I remember reading that one of the reasons that they never wrote for the program has nothing to do with Andrew Cartmell not inviting them back at all. It is because they were annoyed at the Time and the Rani rename of this story.
I think at one point as well, they considered calling it The Strange Matter when they knew that Colin wasn't coming back, because they thought anything could happen. So we'll call it The Strange Matter.
Of the firing of the Doctor.
Strange matter itself is a theoretical substance which is made when atoms are put under very high pressure. So an example I've read is if you take an iron atom, which has 26 protons and 30 neutrons, and you crush it, you apply energy to the protons and the neutrons. If you crush it enough, there's so much energy applied that the protons and neutrons break down into their requisite quarks. And there's up quarks and there's down quarks. Positive
bloody
charge,
dominators
negative charge.
Again.
If you apply even more pressure to these quarks, some of them flip. So they go from being up to down or down to up. And some of them stay in an intermediate state called strange quarks, which are super dense. And that's where strange matter being incredibly heavy comes
from.
They
have colours and flavours as well.
Yes.
It's very silly.
I think they're making it up.
Yeah, they are.
What's now, wrong with the theory that, you know, little sprites inhabit everything?
Works for Conan Doyle.
God sustains it all. Very simple.
Now, we haven't been able to create strange matter on Earth, but the theory is that it could form at the hearts of neutron stars because of the immense pressures they're in. And if strange matter is negatively charged, it'll consume the rest of the star around it and then shoot off into the universe.
Yes.
If it comes into a contact with a planetary body while it is negatively charged, anything it touches is converted to strange matter and joins itself like a snowball. Now, the thing is, theoretically, all strange matter will be positively charged, which means we could actually just have it sitting here on the table and we'd be fine. So that's,
except it would fall through the table.
Except it would fall through the table. So that's why the Rani is trying to come up with a lightweight substitute. Now, from what I can tell, from what I've read, it doesn't seem that strange matter combined with strange matter will make the strange matter explode, as is implied in the story. But that's just the first part of her plan. The second part, of course, is that a shell of chronons will form in the upper atmosphere of Lucertia, which will cause the creation of helium-2, which will cause the matter of the brain, her giant brain, to expand until the space between the surface and the space between the chronon shell is full. The Doctor tells us that this will create a time manipulator. And I think that there is actually a purpose behind this. I don't think it's just a bunch of random words.
Well, you know, I'm fairly sure it is.
Okay. So
empirical thinking is the secret to understanding time manipulation. What's the line?
That's so
Pip and Jane. So
yeah. We're going to have this giant planet-sized brain. Surrounding the brain is going to be a shell of chronons, discrete particles of time, which do not interact with the universe in the same way that normal space-time does. It doesn't go forward at 1 second per second. It doesn't go backwards. It's kind of static time, if you like. And using this, the Rani hopes to manipulate evolution throughout the universe. What I suggest is the brain would actually compute alternative timelines, which the Rani would then enact. And because it's surrounded by the chronon shell, the brain will never change. So it will always be aware of what the universe was like before. So it's like the control in a time change experiment.
So, Brendan, if she's able to come up with such a clever plan, why is she unable to put a hinge on the rocket launcher thing so that she can launch the rocket, you know, at any time she likes?
Or indeed have steering rockets on the bloody rocket itself so you can actually, you know, hit your target.
Yeah, guided missile.
Yeah,
oh,
like,
Rani,
you know,
for goodness sake.
Thing, that thing.
You know, I think somewhere in the novelization of Time of the Rani,
everyone
dies. Pip and Jane actually mentioned that the Tetraps and the Lucertians haven't found the principle of hinges.
She could have mentioned it, they have doors on Gallifrey.
Well, they are all... Oh, no, there are swinging doors on Gallifrey.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know that. But the thing is, this is a story, and the science of it did actually make me look into the science of it as a kid. Now, I didn't look into it with any great depth, but I looked up what's helium-2. Oh, it was something that theoretically existed at the beginning of the universe and is highly unstable. What's a chronon? Oh, it's a discrete particle of time. You know what I mean?
It's very 60s educative Doctor Who.
Exactly right. I think that's exactly right. And they do it in all of their stories. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how I know what Vionesium is. Something they made up.
That's the thing. I think in terms of scientific instruction, this is way below Mark of the Rani, but way ahead of the megabyte modem.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, bliss.
Oh, but I know we said it several times before, but isn't Doctor Who fun again?
I hope the podcast is
Dear listeners, we're taking off for the pink skies of Lucertia, and I feel like a dip, so do come back for Paradise Towers next week. Until then, you can find us online at flightthroughentirety.sexy, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. Over on Bondfinger, we are currently enjoying the Pierce Brosnan era of the program.
Much as you can enjoy reusing a tea bag in a strainer, squeezed it out sufficiently.
That's at bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at FTE Podcast
Pierce
on Twitter.
Was teabagging. There you go. You heard it first.
So we are now nominating for our Peter Davison commentary. Todd has nominated Four to Doomsday. I have nominated Ark of Infinity. Richard has nominated Enlightenment. And Nathan has nominated Resurrection of the Daleks, which, just a reminder, dear listener, he hates. So you can find the poll for that in our show notes, and we will be posting that elsewhere as well. Until next week, may all your lie-hargles be lightweight substitutes. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Good night.
Thank you for bearing with us. Good night.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. Logo design by Anthony Wells. This episode, Terrified of Tinsel, was recorded on the 12th of June 2017. The next episode will be released on the 2nd of July. Do come back next week when Richard Briers will impersonate Mel using only a goat, a prize-winning marrow, and Felicity Kendall's last posh frock. It's kind of doing things that Doctor Who hasn't really done before. The closest we've got to Mel impersonating the Rani is a couple of robot Doctor Whos in the past.
You just said Mel impersonating the Rani.
Thank you.
Works both ways.